Jazz United. I'm Nate Chenin, editorial director at WBGO.
And this is Greg Bryant. I host Jazz After Hours on WBGO. We like to talk about issues in the music community as well as generally what's just on our minds here on Jazz United. And oftentimes on our minds is the music of Thelonious Fear Monk.
He's kind of never not on our minds, mm-hmm. but there is a specific prompt for us.
There is.
There's a reason that we're talking about him this week.
Absolutely, Nate. The often talked about Palo Alto recording is not going to be released publicly. We just found that out about a week ago. And that's really unfortunate for a lot of Monk fans. But we do have information on a killer new Monk recording by a great saxophonist, Teodros Avery, that we're going to talk about later.
So we're taking the opportunity to use both of those pieces of information as a springboard to talk about Monk, talk about his place in history, his place in the lineage, and the ways in which his music continues to push us today. And that leads me to a question, Greg. I know Monk means a lot to you, as he does to so many of us.
Right.
Trace that history for me. When? How far back does it go?
Wow. That would be 7 years old.
Seven years old. What does the music of Thelonious Monk do to the seven-year-old curious mind?
It made young Greg Bryant very curious and very happy. My grandfather and grandmother had a super, I would say, eclectic collection of Black American music. They had everything from Lionel Richie to Dinah Washington, Sketches of Spain, Miles Davis, and Thelonious Monk. And after my grandfather passed, a year later, I was visiting my grandmother and that collection that remained, just trying to get more of his essence and know more about him. Mm-hmm. And flipping through the LPs, lo and behold, there was one called Monk's Dream. And a gentleman
Monk's
was
Dream.
On the cover, yeah, with this hip hat and short kind of cropped beard. And I knew there was something in those grooves and I had to put it on.
Well, before we go any further, I think we have to commune with Monk's Dream. This is, of course, featuring his quartet with Charlie Rouse on tenor saxophone. And on this album, John Orr on bass and Frankie Dunlop on drums.
That's it.
And this was recorded in the fall of 1962 and released the following March. Mm-hmm. So it was the spring of 1963. Title track, Monk's Dream.
The swingin' Thelonious Monk Quartet, Monk's Dream, from his debut for Columbia Records, actually. John Orr on the bass, Frankie Dunlop was the drummer there. Charlie Rouse took the tenor solo. What an incredible group that was.
So swinging. Mm-hmm. That is the word. So you had this instinctive response to that music at seven.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to share something with you. Mm-hmm. This was also my gateway.
That's cool.
This album was the one for me.
I knew that's why we clicked. Absolutely.
And I'll tell you, I have a little story. It's mm-hmm. not as beautifully personal as yours, but it's kind of funny. So you were seven. Mm-hmm. I think I was about 11.
Nice.
And I loved it. I mean, it was so swinging. Mm-hmm. Everything about Monk's playing spoke to me. It just made sense. And I remember my family was over at a friend's house, like a family friend's house for dinner. And, you know, my dad was kind of amused at how excited I was. And so we started talking about music and he said, hey, why don't you put that CD on that you were playing in the car? Hmm. And so I put on Monk's Dream. The guy who was hosting us, this family friend, he said, what's the big deal? I could play this. And I remember my 11-year-old self looking at this grown man mm-hmm. and feeling pity. And I sometimes sure. joke and say that that was the moment that I became a critic.
Okay.
But this idea of like, oh, right, like not yeah. everybody is going to get this.
Exactly.
Like, it's not like people aren't going to respond to it always the way that I am, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's something that has to be said about Thelonious Monk.
Sure.
Like, he is the hippest of the hip.
Right.
Which, you know, by definition means that not everybody can be on board right away.
That's it. I want to give you another story, too, that kind of ties in with that. Years later, when I was 19 years old in Nashville, I had been playing bass maybe for about 6 months and went to hear the Thelonious Monk Sextet, that is the T.S. Monk Sextet, his son, the drummer, and was blown away by all the presentation. I went outside, just outside of the door, and T.S. Monk actually walked up right beside me, lit a cigarette, and was just chilling. I was awestruck and didn't really know if I should talk to him or not. But I struck up a conversation, and it went really well. It was very refreshing. And at the end of it, he says, "So you told me you just started playing bass, right?" I said, "Yes, sir." He's like, "Listen, man, you're going to want to play, or someone's going to present you with an opportunity to play my dad's music. And it's hard. It's really hard, but listen to this,
true
man,
words.
And never forget it. You can always hum the melodies. Somehow you can always hum it." And I went home yeah. with the biggest determination to solve that riddle. And I was like, how can you hum music that's supposed to be so pedagogically challenging? Mm. But he was right. You know, you don't hear people humming Charlie Parker, as amazing an architect as Bird is, but you can always hum Monk's music. Apparently he wrote the tune named after him, Thelonious, so that even a tone deaf person could hum it. That's Monk's words. So
it's so true. And it's so much about deceptive ease, you know, uh-huh. is that the phrase, uh-huh. you know, this idea of, okay, well, here's a single note. And if we just play this single note with some syncopation, mm-hmm. but then everything underneath it is going to shift.
Okay.
You
yeah.
know, and there's going to be this yeah. kind of, you know, it's like you're fixing your focus on a point in the distance
uh-huh.
and the landscape is swirling mm-hmm. around it or something.
That's,
you know?
That's it, man. That's it.
But what do you make, you know, what did you make then and what do you make now of this idea that thankfully I haven't heard as much lately, mm-hmm. but this idea that Monk was in part defined by a kind of technical limitation.
Mm. You
know? This is something that Oscar Peterson once said, you know, mm-hmm. that he was limited
yeah.
As a pianist.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of critics have made some kind of observation, and quite a few musicians over the years made that observation. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what your response to that argument is.
Wow. I would say this. I disagree with them 100%. Doing a bit of sleuthing in the early 2000s on the Monk website, there was actually a bootleg that the family put out of Monk playing Chopin, mm-hmm. practicing, and it literally was to the letter. It was magnificently articulated. It was just as if someone were studying classically and doing the best job possible.
Mm-hmm.
To know Monk is to know that he unlearned the quote-unquote right way to play his own way. And when you think about being influenced by the stride masters that he was, people like James P. Johnson and even Duke Ellington, who loved Thelonious, to playing behind a faith healer, you know, in his early 20s or late teens, you know, getting that gospel music grounding, and then falling in love with the music of big bands and orchestration. Those three elements really make up the complexity of Monk's style. And I really yeah. couldn't say that he was not a technical piano player. I think he was very much so, and he had to be to make his own style.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a few years ago, Vijay Iyer wrote a column for Jazz Times, a guest column, mm-hmm. in which he talked about Monk and the issue of technique. And I thought that was a really astute piece, because he's basically framing this in terms of, you know, what do we mean when we use the word technique?
Okay.
You know, and someone like Amiri Baraka, who was very influential in Vijay's thinking and in my own thinking, you know, he makes the argument that you really shouldn't be using that Western classical idea, you know, the Chopin idea. Mm-hmm. That is not what technique necessarily means. And if you think about the architecture and the sort of the sonic principles of Monk's pianism, you know, it's incredibly deep and it's really difficult to deal with in a way that is not caricature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny, like every young musician, I mean, I know you did and I did too. Every young musician comes up playing Straight No Chaser.
Sure.
And, you know, sure. Like these are some of the first tunes you learn. Mm-hmm. They're easy to play.
Mm-hmm.
They're not easy to play well.
Yes, sir.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. No.
And so, again, it's that deceptive ease thing. It's really, yeah, it's really interesting. You know, it was just a few years ago that we commemorated Monk's centennial.
You're right.
In 2017. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of tributes,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people that decided to take that opportunity to record his music.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you checked some of that out, right?
I did. Miles Okazaki, the guitar mm-hmm. player, did a very brilliant tribute to the complete works of Thelonious Monk and adapted them to the guitar. Peter Bernstein did a Monk album as well as Bobby Broom. But one that I want to really ask you about that you had some involvement in on the liner notes side of things was the Frank Kimbrough tribute. It was a boxed set for Sunnyside called Monk's Dreams.
Right. Yeah, you know, similar to the Miles Okazaki album mm-hmm. in that it's the complete recordings,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, depending on how you look at it, the complete recordings is a big corpus of work, or it's not that big, depending on, you know.
Right.
As a composer, Monk didn't write hundreds and hundreds of tunes.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote enough of them that taking on the entire body of work is no small feat. And so Frank Kimbrough, who has been, you know, really he was informed by Monk and by Bill Evans, you know,
right.
in his early years. Mm-hmm. And he found it useful how different they were as pianists and as you know, melodists.
Mm-hmm.
But writing the notes for this album or for this box set, mm-hmm. It was a really interesting exercise because Frank decided that he was going to take the unit that most defined Monk's music,
uh-huh.
so quartet with saxophone,
right.
piano, bass, and drums.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to take that and he was going to perform the compositions really the way that they had been intended, you know, the way that Monk played them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, with very few exceptions, they didn't mess around with the way that the tunes lay, the way that they unfold.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Frank wrestled with was, okay, so how do you deal with that honestly in a way that feels true to the compositions but doesn't tilt over into imitation?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I would argue that you could not make this album if you were not experienced the way that Frank and his fellow musicians, you know, in this case, multi-instrumentalist Scott Robinson,
uh-huh.
the bassist Rufus Reed,
right.
and the drummer Billy Drummond, you know, these guys have all been around the block.
Yes.
And so
yes.
they are secure enough in their own identities and selves that they don't feel the need to put a lot of spin on it.
Right.
You know?
That's right.
They can play
right.
it straight and have it sound and feel like Monk, but also sound and feel like themselves.
Indeed.
I know there's a lesser known Monk tune that you love, Greg, called Break's Sake.
Sure thing.
And
sure
like
thing.
I said, this is the complete recordings.
Yeah.
So let's hear Break's Sake performed by the Frank Kimbrough Quartet.
One of the lesser-known Thelonious Monk tunes called Break's Sake. Frank Kimbrough at the piano, Scott Robinson, also Billy Drummond and Rufus Reed making up that fantastic quartet that gave us Monk's Dreams on Sunnyside Records. Nate Chinin with the liner notes on that, as a matter of fact.
You know, we're talking about the centennial and those tributes, but it's worth noting that nobody really needed a special occasion to play Monk's music. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of just in the air and in the water, you know?
Yeah.
And especially among pianists, you know, Frank belongs to this generation that has always revered Monk.
Right.
You know, there's a generation that includes Fred Hirsch mm-hmm. and the late Jerry Allen.
Sure.
You know, they always have played Monk's music. And then as we get closer, you know, further down the line, Monk is maybe the most important figure for you know, the aforementioned Vijay Iyer mm-hmm. and Jason Moran and yeah. Chris Davis.
Yeah.
You know, he's just, he's elemental.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
But it's not just pianists either.
Not at all. Not at all. I think Monk is really a prototype from the 1950s forward of the composer musician, the musician that writes his own material to address not only his own growth in the music, but what's around him as well, and making things lighthearted, always swinging, but challenging the ear and the mind, and somehow all in that stew, in that brew. As we've talked about earlier, there's an accessibility to that comes across. I think that's a big reason why in the middle 60s, not only the Columbia recording contract that allowed Monk to have greater visibility, but finally in being persistent about playing his own tunes, sometimes two and three times on records, there's now this appetite for the music. It's not this outlier. It's part of the jazz canon. It's part of the language all of a sudden.
The language, for mm-hmm. sure. Yeah, yeah. I suppose it is technically possible to be a top tier improvising musician and not deal seriously with Monk's music, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Me either.
You know, to get away from the piano for a moment uh-huh. and think about his compositions like untethered from the keyboard, mm-hmm. Maybe we should hear an example of a band that dealt really deeply with his music with a different palette.
Sure.
And I'm thinking specifically of the Paul Motion Electric Bebop band.
Nice choice.
From the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, this is a band that I used to love seeing at the Village Vanguard. Mm-hmm. And this edition of the band had a real Monk expert, Steve Cardenas,
yes.
on guitar, alongside another guitarist, Kurt Rosenwinkel, the twin tenors, Chris Potter and Chris Cheek,
yes.
and Steve Swallow on acoustic bass guitar.
Yes. Yes.
And so one tune that I thought might be fun is from this album recorded in 1998. It's called San Francisco Holiday.
San Francisco Holiday, also known as Worry Later in some circles.
That's right.
The Paul Motion Electric Bebop Band, a killer group. No piano, but everything else is covered. They didn't leave anything out on that.
And San Francisco, of course, is, about 35 miles from Palo Alto,
uh-huh.
which was the site of this, you know, legendary and elusive album.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also titled Palo Alto, and it was originally scheduled to be released on Impulse Records mm-hmm. on July 31st.
Yeah.
I was, you know, as you say, I was excited mm-hmm. about this. At NPR Music, we helped to break that news,
yeah.
and it was something I was really looking forward to, having a lot of folks hear this music.
Sure.
So we're not going to rub it in here, mm-hmm. because I know,
but we could.
You know, we have both spent time with this album, and yeah. you know, it is as good as everyone says.
Absolutely. You know, why this stings? Why does this hurt? You know, if Monk mm-hmm. ever had a classic quartet, you know, as we sometimes bandy that term with the John Coltrane group, but Monk's classic quartet would be this group. Larry Gales was the bassist, Ben Riley was the drummer, and Charlie Rouse, Monk's longtime sideman, was in the tenor chair. T.S. Monk, Thelonious's son, said they'd sound just as great playing in a phone booth as they would sound playing in Carnegie Hall. And it's really true. They had an ease over the repertoire. They knew all the music. There was no set list. It was just based on a vibe and feel. Wherever Monk went, those gentlemen were right there with him. And yeah, this is a real loss. But man, what can you do? They've got to make things right first.
Well, this was not recorded in a phone booth, but it was recorded in a high school auditorium. Mm-hmm. and the circumstances of that are interesting. You know, mm-hmm. it's a really fascinating story. There was a high school kid named Danny Scherer mm-hmm. who was just beginning to get into promoting music. And his two favorite artists were Monk and Duke Ellington. And he learned that Monk was going to be in town playing a gig in San Francisco. And long story short, he managed to book Monk for this assembly at Pali, mm-hmm. Palo Alto High School.
Yeah.
Pali was and is a mostly white institution. And East Palo Alto was a predominantly black community. And in 1968, there was a lot of unrest in that community, as we've seen this summer.
Yeah.
And in fact, at the time, East Palo Alto was considering a referendum to change the name of that city to Nairobi in an expression of black pride. Mm. You know, it was an unincorporated community, so they had no say in governance. You know, it was really plagued by poverty. Police mistreatment was an issue. Mm. So there's actually quite a bit of resonance between what was happening there at that time and what we are currently experiencing in this country.
Right.
But this Monk concert was an opportunity to bring everyone together,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Danny Scherer talks about how there were people in East Palo Alto who looked at this, you know, teenage white kid and said, "You're telling me that Monk's going to be playing at your school?"
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, and what he said was, "Look, show up. You don't even have to buy a ticket. Show up in the parking lot. And if Monk shows up, you can buy your ticket."
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what they did, uh-huh. you know.
That's right.
But there's also some interesting perspective on where Monk was at this time. You know, even though Monk had been on the cover of Time magazine in the middle 60s, between 66 and 67, he didn't break $20,000 in take-home pay.
Wow.
At the time that he shows up in Palo Alto, his current album was Underground.
Yeah, that's another good one. That's the one basically where Monk wins a Grammy, but not for the music. Mm-hmm. For the cover art, you know, the art department basically puts this push behind Monk to appeal to basically the counterculture generation. And if you see this cover and its detail, it's basically an attempt to kind of take Monk's music a little bit out of its original vibe, if I can say it that way, because what you hear is just Monk doing his thing as well as ever. As a matter mm-hmm. of fact, I would argue that that's one of his strongest albums for Columbia. You know, tunes that musicians are playing these days, like Ugly Beauty, that's a part of this album.
This Grammy-winning cover, it's an illustration of Monk at the piano mm-hmm. in this kind of grotto-like underground lair,
yeah.
surrounded by munitions and weapons, mm-hmm. you know, grenades and machine guns. And, you know, it's this idea that he's part of the French resistance or something.
Yeah.
But obviously there is a tie to sort of radical black politics of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this, and I actually don't know the extent to which the label was trying to invoke an organization like the Black Panthers,
mm.
but it doesn't seem like a stretch, you know,
yeah.
they were sort of reaching and trying to position Monk as this kind of countercultural figure, right?
Right.
Columbia's pitch to the rock generation really did not take. And so as a result, Monk was in a pretty difficult spot financially in 1968. His biographer, Robin Kelly, really author of one of the great jazz biographies of all time.
Yeah.
I spoke with him about the circumstances around Palo Alto, and this is what he had to say.
When he had an opportunity to do this gig at Palo Alto High School, which was basically $500, he took it. He didn't take it simply because he was doing Danny Scher a favor, you know, because he liked this gutsy kid. He needed the money, you know. Also in 68, in May, he had suffered some kind of seizure, and he was in a coma for several days. So imagine, you're in a coma, no one knows if you're going to live or die. He has a record date with Columbia. Columbia decides, since he can't make it, to charge him the full studio fee for the record gig. So, you know, and even though he hadn't fully recovered, he still had to go on the road to make money. So it was a very, very difficult moment, and we wouldn't know it because if you look at it from the perspective of the press, he was at the top of his game.
Wow, what a sobering revelation. And that was 1968 circumstances that aren't much unlike 2020 circumstances regarding the music business and freelancers in general, without a network of support, you know, for health insurance or better working conditions. Oftentimes, you have to make some serious decisions if you're going to exist. And Monk's example is really an heroic one. You know, you got the blues, you know, play through them, do the gig. You know, you've got adversity in life, you know, that's okay. Brush it off as best you can and make it to the gig, do the gig. It's really a testament to the human spirit more than anything, Nate. And it just makes my respect for Monk go up even more, knowing that he was under such duress and just heroically rallying the troops to make that record.
And here is where, you know, in a happier world, we would be playing some music from that, that Palo Alto concert, because there is nothing that better illustrates what you're saying than the buoyancy and the fire and the joy in the music. And I don't want to annoy people raving about this thing that is not accessible at the moment.
Right.
I will say, you know, one thing. We would not have this recording at all if not for the fact that a janitor at the school offered to record it. And Danny Scher said, sure, go ahead.
Yeah.
So we don't know exactly why this has been tangled up. But one thing we do know is that it's unclear not only when, but whether this album will see release.
Right.
And that's a tough thing. But my colleague Yoshi Kato wrote an article for Palo Alto Weekly that got into some of this. And he quotes Danny Scher as saying, they're not saying it's delayed. They're saying, we'll let you know if it's being released, not when.
Ooh, wow.
And then he says, I've held on to this recording for 50 years, so I can hold on to it for another two or three decades. So that's the right spirit.
Man.
And, you know, in the interest of offering our listeners a little something, you know, we can't play music from this release, but why don't we take a song that was performed at Palo Alto?
Yeah.
And here's another live recording from a handful of months later. So this is Monk's quartet, again with Charlie Rouse.
Yes.
Playing Blue Monk. The bassist and drummer are different. It's a young bassist named Nate Heigeland. And then Monk's old friend, Philly Joe Jones, on drums.
All right.
So this was recorded in Paris in 1969. Blue Monk.
That's Blue Monk from Thelonious Monk, featuring among the cast the great Charlie Rouse on tenor and Philly Joe Jones sitting in with his old buddies there on the drums. But Nate, the legacy of Monk continues. It really never stops. Never. it's all in the music. You know, when you think about, you know, who would be a central figure to embody the full history of this music, Thelonious Monk comes right to mind. And maybe that's one of the reasons when cats want to get authentic and really show that they're connected to this from not only an historical place, but from a forward-thinking place, the music right. of Monk fits the bill.
I thought about this a bit around his centennial. There are few figures in the music who mean so much to so many different kinds of players. You know, if you are a straight-up swinging cat, you know, somebody who really has no inclination towards experimentation, you know, but just really like loves swinging, mm-hmm. loves the blues, mm-hmm. Monk is going to mean something special to you. And if you are, you know, way out on a limb, you know, really experimental avant-gardist, Monk is going to mean something to you in that case too.
Right.
You know, I feel like he's one of those musicians who is pretty universal mm-hmm. in his relevance and in his appeal.
I think that's very true. Some cats that come to mind from a wide spectrum of the artistic expression would be Wynton Marsalis. I think he interprets Monk fantastically. Another guy who I like to hear really get into the crux of Thelonious's construction is Peter Bernstein. I think he has a unique take on that. But when you think about folks that come out of the example, you know, like Andrew Hill, and then these days you mentioned Vijay Iyer, you know, and cats of his ilk, Jason Moran, even.
Yeah.
There is a Thelonious bone in both of their bodies, and you really yeah. can, it's unmistakable. That's their guy.
I love hearing both of them play Monk. I love hearing Brad Meldow play Monk. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned Jerry Allen earlier. I loved anytime she touched Round Midnight. That was a special occasion,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
There's so many. And actually, it keeps coming.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a brand new recording that you and I have checked out
yeah.
By a tenor saxophonist named Teodros Avery.
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember when he first hit the scene in the 90s?
Man, I
were
do.
Were you checking him out?
I do. He was one of those cats that you had to watch. He was on the vanguard, on the cusp of the tenors of our times, you and I, Nate, you know, when we were yeah. first getting into the music.
He released his first album on Impulse mm-hmm. in 1996, and he titled it My Generation.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
and so there was a real sense of like, okay, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are to put our spin on this music. And one of the things that has been really nice in the last, you know, couple of years is seeing him come back as a recording artist. You know, there was a long stretch where he never stopped playing, but he wasn't releasing music,
right.
you know? So thankfully, last year we saw him put out a Coltrane album called After the Rain, A Night for Coltrane.
Mm.
And now we have his Monk tribute.
Right.
And he is calling this Harlem Stories, mm-hmm. the music of Thelonious Monk.
I love it.
And it's out on WJ3, which is the label started by drummer Willie Jones III.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's a really, really nice effort. So what do you have to say about this album? How did it strike you?
Absolutely swinging. Just a good time mm-hmm. all the way from start to finish. You know, there's the spirit of Monk's music, but there's the spirit of individual truth. And what better way to represent both of those things on this new effort? I really look forward to make the not only the critics' circles, but to become a fan favorite pretty quickly, actually.
You know, one thing that's interesting to me about it is that Teodros chooses to play with two different pianists, dividing it, you know, almost like a side A, side B experience.
Yeah.
And so on side A, he's got Anthony Wanzi on piano. And on side B, he's got Dee Dee Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And these are two really distinct approaches
right.
to Monk's music.
Absolutely.
I'd characterize Wanzi's playing as a little more like crisp
mm-hmm.
and fluid and
mm-hmm.
and kind of I guess maybe a little more boppish
mm-hmm.
and Dee Dee Jackson is like he's coming in with the expressionism, you know, sure. And it's a more, and you know, maybe a little bit more of a connection to the stride piano side of Monk, mm-hmm. a little bit more all over the keyboard.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so it, both approaches sound just terrific. Mm-hmm. And you know, Teodros sounds like he's having a blast.
Indeed.
Throughout the
Indeed.
Album.
Indeed. What's really cool, if I can venture out, Willie Jones III sounds like he belongs in a Thelonious Monk band. And that's not a limitation. Yeah. That's an true. Attribute. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a handful of musicians who I've seen over the years, and it's occurred to me at one point or another, like, man, Monk would have loved having this
yes.
person
yeah.
in his band.
Absolutely,
you know? And,
man.
And I think you're right about Willie Jones mm-hmm. III. I think he would have been a great Monk drummer.
Yeah.
I've had that thought about Herlin Riley.
Ooh, good choice.
Another drummer, you know.
Good choice.
I think Herlin would have, you know, really sounded great with Monk.
Absolutely.
You know, Frank Kimbrough made this point about why he chose Rufus Reed mm-hmm. and Billy Drummond.
Yeah.
You know, and with Rufus especially, you know, Frank said, had Rufus come along just a few years earlier, he might have been one of Monk's
yes, he would have.
Side.
Yes, he would know. Have. Absolutely.
We could play this game all day.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we should go out with the opening track from Harlem Stories,
mm-hmm.
And this is you know, serendipitously, this is a track titled Tio.
Yeah, yeah. Here it is.
Jazz United is a production of WBGO. Our producer is Sarah Kirsten. Our senior producer is Simon Rentner. The theme song for Jazz United is United, a Wayne Shorter composition performed by Newark's own Woody Shaw. You can find links to all the music in this episode on our show page, where you can also find links to articles about the great Thelonious Monk. Please subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and don't be shy about leaving us a rating.
Please do, folks. We enjoy doing these, and just a little bit of a heads up. We're going to take a break in September, but we'll be back strong in October. But not to worry, you can catch up on all 5 episodes. And as Nate said, leave us a review. Tell your friends about us. It's always great to be with you. Until October, take care. We'll see you soon.